Good afternoon. The Surface Transportation Board, December's 2021 approval of the construction and operation of the Uinta Basin Railway was struck down by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia on August 18th. Good afternoon. I'm Steve Evans with News Talk 104.5 FM and AM 920 KVL. What does this ruling mean for the project going forward? We've invited to participate in this program representatives from the Uinta Basin Railway. Joining us for our discussion this evening are Mark Michel with Drexel Hamilton Infrastructure Partners, Keith Heaton, who is serving as the executive director of the Seven County Infrastructure Coalition, and Duchesne County Commissioner Greg Miles, who also serves as co-chair of the Seven County Infrastructure Coalition. I'll give you a little bit of background. Opponents, including various environmental organizations, including the Center for Biological Diversity and Eagle County, Colorado, have petitioned the Court of Appeals, arguing in part that the STB environmental impact statement and biological opinion was flawed. Now, the court ruled that the approval of the Uinta Basin Railway by Federal Transportation Board be vacated, stating in part that the board failed to weigh in on the project's uncertain financial viability and the full potential for environmental harm against the transportation benefits it identified. Now, the project does have full support with both state and federal lawmakers. Congressman John Curtis was quick to respond with this comment. He said the court's decision to stop the project, which was approved by the Biden administration, is harmful and foolish. The railroad will help Utah lead the way in emission reductions and environmental stewardship, improve safety, and increase energy independence. And he stated that he looks forward to this issue being quickly resolved. I might mention that Congressman Curtis is also founder of the Conservative Climate Caucus, which focuses on reducing world emissions by producing reliable, clean energy in the United States. Senator Mike Lee was quick to respond, also stating that this is a blow against the Uinta Basin project, represents a missed opportunity for our communities to thrive. The National Environmental Policy Act and the accompanying environmental impact statement, he stated, for the project were both thorough and exhaustive in their evaluation. So the decision is a needless setback for Utah. Now, the Uinta Basin Railway project is not just about American energy. He stated it's about jobs, it's about economic growth and prosperity for our great state. Now, the Uinta Basin Railway team has also responded, and I'll let them speak for themselves, but the response was basically the Uinta Basin team remains committed to the successful planning, construction, and operation of the railway. It goes on to say that we firmly believe that the railway's environmental impact statement contains appropriate and thorough analysis of the highlighted concerns as it stands today. Now, I want to mention to the team, is this statement that was released a little over a week ago, would you add anything to that statement? Is it pretty fair? Are we still committed? Is this project going forward? Commissioner Miles?
I would say absolutely. We're in this for the win. We see the benefits that this project will make for the basin. And we've come this far. We've got fight left in us. We will get a win.
Okay. You have anything to add, Keith?
Well, thank you, Steve. Good afternoon.
Yeah, good afternoon.
Yeah, I am 100% committed to this project, as is the rest of the Seven County Infrastructure Coalition, and I firmly believe that this project will happen. This is a minor setback, a speed bump on the road that may slow this project down for a year or two, but we are moving forward full steam, and we will get it across the finish line.
Mark Michel, for those who don't know you, I'd like to ask you what your position is on the project and how long have you been involved, and what can you tell us about Drexel Hamilton and what role does your organization play in the project?
Sure. Thanks for having me again, Steve. We are the private partner that's working alongside Keith and Greg and the rest of our public partners there at the Seven County Infrastructure Coalition. We're responsible for the commercialization and the financing of the project, and we've been helping to advance the project with regards to the permitting and the geotech and all sorts of different acquisition of right-of-way pieces, things that we can go ahead and put capital into that advances the project's construction and fruition. So as far as a background on our firm, so we've been actually around the project since May of 2019 when we answered the RFP and were selected by the Seven County Infrastructure Coalition to work alongside the public entity to advance the project. But as a matter of who we are, we're a financial services asset management firm that develops and acquires infrastructure, real assets, infrastructure assets. We love the transportation space, such as this. We find real value in unlocking stranded and captive markets that really should be able to compete on parity with other markets of its peers, in the global markets. And differentiators is we're fully owned and operated by U.S. military veterans. So we're a wholly owned service disabled veteran owned firm. So we have a great experience in U.S. government, particularly in the Department of Defense, and been around a lot of complicated projects that aren't always clean and easy to just kind of move out the gates. There's sometimes hiccups like this that happen, but that's something that we didn't see in Afghanistan or Iraq, and have to contend with various different challenges along the way, and we find a way to persevere and overcome those.
Mark Michel, from your experience, have you seen an opposition like this? What is your opinion on the viability of this project going forward?
Oh, I think it's absolutely, as Keith said, it's absolutely needed, and it will happen. Rarely are there infrastructure projects that aren't challenged in some way, form, or fashion. We've seen this happen a lot on different assets out there across the country. And, ultimately, you have to believe in the fundamentals that, when there's a real need in the marketplace and in a community that really needs to have access and fair access to markets and to commercial viability, that you're able to provide those infrastructure assets to benefit of people in a region. It's no secret that there's a great amount of resources in Northeast Utah, and those should absolutely have the ability to make it to market and create jobs and create a tax base and create prosperity for Northeast Utah and the entire state of Utah and frankly the entire Rocky Mountain West. It's a very clean and high quality oil that, frankly, is there to potentially be able to supplant dirtier hydrocarbons coming from different regions that currently are providing these hydrocarbons to the refinery markets. Uenta Basin crude is higher quality, that it has lower emissions, and is just frankly a superior product that honestly, if you were an environmentalist and with all the intellectual honesty here, they should want to use this type of crude to create things that are really the products that this creates, which is the cosmetics and lubricants and plastics and things that occur throughout the normal products of life that are absolutely really required for to live in a modern society. Right now, they're using a lot dirtier type of crude to create those products in the oil refineries throughout the nation, and this would be just a much more superior and higher quality product that reduces carbon emissions.
One of the court rulings has questioned the financial viability of the project. Is the project financially viable going forward? Is there financial support behind it, and what is the commitment of Drexel Hamilton going forward? Is it 100%, 80%, 60%?
No, I mean we were hoping to make some announcements that would have been already out, but this court ruling has obviously slowed some stuff down. But we are working with commercial partners that are major international energy companies and terminal services providers and transportation providers. We've gotten the project to a commercial viability, 100% commercial viability at this point, This has caused a little bit of a hiccup just to kind of work through the legal nuances and identify the path forward. But, when there is a financial viability, a commercial viability, and then you look at what really should happen on a theoretical scale should this region of the country have the opportunity to access markets, it really comes down to somewhat of even of a fairness issue where, the government should not necessarily be putting its fingers on the scales of trying to help and better certain areas of the country and not others. So, to answer your question directly, we know that this is a 100% fully financeable and commercially viable project.
Why is the court weighing in on this right now? about the financial viability of it. Do you have an opinion on that?
We haven't had the chance to make the announcements. We were literally in the process of making some announcements within, you know, days of what we thought the court. We were honestly, we were not expecting the court decision to come out this early in the summer and early fall. We thought it was going to take a little bit longer, but you know, I think these things will all resolve themselves. I am less concerned about the financial viability. I think those questions are all going to be answered. Without any hesitation or questions, once we're able to make the public announcement, which we hope still to make that announcement here relatively in short order. But we are obviously working with our legal teams and advisors to make sure that we're doing everything in accordance with the law, and just making sure that we don't have any issues there.
Mark Michel, what precedents are set, unintended consequences on national infrastructure projects going forward if this ruling were to remain permanent?
Well, that's a great question. Frankly, in our view, the fact that you have a political jurisdiction in a municipality in a different state that has been trying to tell a separate state and the state agencies and municipalities in a completely different state, you know, we believe is questions the violation of the Interstate Commerce Clause. Is a big problem that really, frankly, can cut both ways. And so what the court, I think, really needs to understand is whether or not, you know, with this as a precedent in ruling, you could very well have conservative counties in, say, Florida or Texas or North Dakota doing liberal, more, you know, opposite political affiliation counties that are maybe in California or Colorado or Connecticut or someplace like that. For things that they're trying to do in their jurisdictions. This can open up Pandora's box of what counties are telling each other that they can and cannot do. And frankly, they just need to be adjudicated within their own states. But that kind of comes down to some of the fundamental tenets of the 10th Amendment of states' rights and the way that state courts and these things are adjudicated. But you know, we have the court system that we have. I think that, you know, the court ruled the way that they did. You know, we obviously have the ability to go back and ask for either the issue to be elevated to the U.S. Supreme Court, or for us to ask for the entire D.C. Circuit Court to look at this and rule upon it. With more judges looking at the case from the same jurisdictional level. We're working with our legal teams right now to try to figure out what the best path on that is. But you know, we're 100% committed to getting this done. We've been at it for 4 years and have spent a lot of money trying to get it this far, and we have our commercial partners at the table that we know that this is going to be a successful project, and we're excited to carry it forward.
It seems like this is unconstitutional. The Interstate Commerce Clause, which you referred to earlier, restricts states from impairing interstate commerce. Isn't that exactly what this is doing, Colorado?
In my view, I think it's a violation, but I'm not a juris doctorate lawyer. I'll leave that up to others smarter than me in the law, but it presents, I think, a serious level of problems with regard to, you know, really the just grinding down of commerce being able to occur between the states when you have one set of jurisdictions telling others what they can and cannot do in a different, completely different state. So that's why the Pandora's box that I was referring to earlier, it really opens it up to a lot of legal complications that the courts are going to have to wrestle with for many years if this particular part of the ruling stands.
All right. Mark Michel, thank you very much. I want to draw in Commissioner Greg Miles, who also serves as co-chair of the 7-County Infrastructure Coalition. Commissioner Miles, could you explain what the 7-County Infrastructure, briefly what the 7-County Infrastructure Coalition does?
Yeah, that's a big question. 7-County Infrastructure Coalition represents 80% of the minerals that are produced in the state of Utah. So the 7 counties being Daggett, Uinta, Duchesne, Carbon, Emery, Sevier, and San Juan. Okay. And a lot of minerals are produced in those 7 counties. And this was a, excuse me, a brainchild of Senator Winterton and several others, county commissioners that were serving at that time. A way to get big infrastructure projects like Uinta Basin Railway across the finish line. You know, this project on its own is a big lift for one county
right,
to get off the ground. And so the support of those 7 counties
The coalition.
The coalition
gives it more emphasis and more power.
Yes,
I would assume. In the project, in the team's response, it was stated that the project has spent years working to provide a solution to transportation issues in the Uinta Basin through the construction of a railroad, which would connect the industry to the national railway. What challenges does the counties in Uinta Basin, Duchesne and Uinta, have with transportation currently?
I think all of your listeners are very well aware of the winter that we just went through.
Right.
Without a major way to move goods in and out of the basin, we're landlocked. And you've heard, you know, the term isolated empire. Mm-hmm. We've got a lot of possibilities to put people to work here. But without the ability to move goods in and out of the basin, it really, really hampers that.
We're really restricted to Highway 40, U.S. Highway 40 and U.S. 191. North, south, east, west, and those are through very mountainous areas, which could cause a problem with transportation in and out of the Uinta Basin.
Yeah.
How has it affected economic development efforts of Duchesne County?
It's really hampered economic development, and my hat's off to Commissioner Hansen, who has formerly served as
Irene Hansen,
Economic Development Director for the county. Mm-hmm. She has worked tirelessly to get companies involved and interested in coming to the Uinta Basin, and everything checks out until we get to the point where we talk about transportation. And you know, I think of a project that was slated for moving water, you know, upper country water, mm-hmm. Good taste and stuff.
Oh, I remember that.
And
that proposal.
They had looked at a water bottle facility.
Haldimont Water is the best.
It's the best. Yeah, we've been in the top three in the state for years. So they looked at a water bottle filling facility in the upper country, and it honestly came down to not being able to have a rail available. In order to move the feedstock or the plastic bottles and other necessities for transportation, because we didn't have a rail here, it put an end to that project.
So when we're talking about the economic growth of this, that this project would bring, it's beyond oil transportation.
It's far beyond. And I've been hit up several times over the last 4 years about, well, why aren't you talking more about the other possibilities? The possibilities are endless.
Right.
I mean, we can go on and we can talk about fertilizer for agriculture. We can talk about moving hay both in and out of the basin. Mm-hmm. There's producers that ship their hay to Japan and Kentucky and Tennessee. And if we could put that on a rail car, it would open up new markets for them. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. When you talk about beef or pork or so many other things, tubing, drill pipe, I mean, we could go on and
operating,
on. And on.
Operating a business here in the Uinta Basin for the past 30 years, I've seen us go through maybe a half a dozen cyclical ups and downs of the economy, and it seems to be all based on oil and natural gas pricing.
Yeah.
Would this help level the playing field and help stabilize our economic base so we don't have those cycles?
I believe strongly it would. I've watched that same thing, Steve, over the years. I've worked in the oil and gas industry, and I've seen at the end of the fourth quarter, when there's not much drilling money left, that money gets moved to other fields where they don't have these transportation constraints. You know, we're still going
even
to
though
have,
the product isn't quite as good.
Yeah,
and then North Salt Lake is taking a discount off the waxy crude that's being transported out of the Uinta Basin, as I understand it. So that further impedes producers' efforts to make it financially viable in the Uinta Basin. Correct?
And I believe we've gotten a little closer. So on the haircut that producers used to take in North Salt Lake, right. I believe having another option. Moving oil out of the basin, I think we've gotten closer to fair market.
So that's motivated them to maybe come down on the price a little bit more, make it more competitive. Highway 191 traffic through Indian Canyon, as Duchesne County Commissioner, that traffic and people that understand living here in the Uinta Basin, that's a treacherous road, especially in icy and snowy conditions, as families are going up and down that canyon all year long. We're also transporting about 50,000 barrels of waxy crude a day over that highway pass. How will this benefit having this railroad? Is it a safer method of transportation for crude oil than the highway?
Yeah, far safer.
It sounds like a rhetorical question, but I had to ask it.
I think we all know that. And seeing the impact that 191 has taken from that increased truck traffic, I won't speak for UDOT, but just my perspective, it's taking a beating. And thank goodness for Senator Winterton. We appreciate for his support in the state legislature. He was willing and able to get a bill through to the finish line to give us about $88.5 million for UDOT to upgrade 191.
And we have the longest stretch of highway without passing lanes up over that. Yeah. So, I mean, it's a dangerous canyon. And yes, hats off to our Senator Winterton, who's made efforts to make that safer.
But it's not a main thoroughfare. With the heavy truck traffic, I guess it just makes it more difficult. You know, having that many trucks a day mm-hmm. on 191, I just question whether it's sustainable long term. I think, and we all know the benefits of moving goods on a train. You're 3 to 4 times more effective. You know, 1 gallon of diesel will get you 3 to 4 more times per ton than truck will.
Eagle County, Colorado, which includes Aspen. The biggest problem with this has been the city of Glenwood Springs. We're already shipping. The oil has already been shipping through that area. My wife and I vacation there on occasion when we need a marriage enrichment weekend. We go there. But you know, the railway is full of oil crude trains coming through that area anyway. Has there ever been a problem in the past?
Not that I'm aware of. I think there's honestly more dangerous things that are transported by shipping companies on the highway than what's transported on the rail. This waxy crude, it sets up like a candle, as most basin residents are aware. And I've cleaned up spills in my time working in the oil and gas field, and what comes out of those rail cars will pick up with a shovel.
So the paraffin, the heavy paraffin content, just to visually create a visual mindset for people who are listening, you have to heat it to put it in the rail car and heat it to take it out, because it coagulates into a solid form once it's in there. So you wouldn't understand that by listening to public radio in Aspen, Colorado, but you certainly understand it by living here and working around the waxy crude here in the Uinta Basin. So cleanup would be fairly simple if there were an incident.
I agree, and less volatile. You're not putting off as much gas when your crude sets up and it's cold, and these cars are not heated. They will set up, and it's the same way with trucks. You know, the trucks that haul crude to the refinery in North Salt Lake, they're not heated. They don't have a heat source that keeps that crude hot. Mm-hmm. It comes out of the tanks when they fill it into the truck hot. And if they don't get it unloaded in 10 to 12 hours, it's starting to set up.
We also have a lot of traffic that's going over Strawberry on Highway 40 through Heber and down into North Salt Lake, down Parley's Canyon to North Salt Lake. It just seems like the rail would be a good option. What about inland port advantages for having a railway here? Would that benefit, you know, Utah is working on inland port. Would that help you in a basin economy, having a railroad that could go that way too?
Absolutely. Having a spoke for the inland port in the basin would be a game changer.
I want to pull Keith Heaton into this discussion. Now, Keith is the executive director of the 7 County Infrastructure Coalition. That's a full-time job, isn't it, Keith?
Oh, it's a mouthful.
That it is. I want to mention the U-Tribe are important partners with this project, and they've been very supportive of this. Could you maybe speak about the U-Tribe a little bit and the relationship with this project and how important they are to the project going forward?
Well, I will speak about the U-Tribe, not for the U-Tribe.
Yeah. On behalf of the
on behalf of the coalition. They are an invaluable partner. We cannot put a price tag on how important they are to this project, and you know, as well as being friends and neighbors, right? I mean, they are part of this community. We are a community.
Very important part of the community.
I don't see a separation there necessarily. And as we move forward over this speed bump, I think their partnership becomes even more important. Because they are a sovereign nation, I think the federal government listens to them in a different way than they would listen to the counties or the infrastructure coalition or even our private partners. So partnerships are critical. That is the entire foundation of the Seven County Infrastructure Coalition, is the seven counties working together and then bringing in private partners like Drexel Hamilton Infrastructures, like the Ute Tribe, to work on these major infrastructure projects. Projects like this, as is evident, are a very heavy lift. And it's only by working together that we get those things done. So we're very grateful for the Ute Tribe, and we'll be leaning on their partnership heavily over the next coming months.
Now, in the court ruling, Keith Heaton, they mentioned that there were numerous NEPA violations. Could you explain NEPA and EIS process and the measures that the Seven County Infrastructure Coalition and the Surface Transportation Board has made to make sure that that this project met all of those requirements?
I'll do my best. I'm not an environmental expert, and National Environmental Protection Agency environmental impact statements are all the acronyms that you threw out there. And then the Surface Transportation Board is the STB. So they're the governing body for a railroad project from the federal government. And so to move projects like this forward, you need to have a number of permits from different federal agencies. In our case, it's the Surface Transportation Board and the Forest Service, Bureau of Indian Affairs, because, again, they are partners in this, and a part of this railroad will go through tribal lands.
Right.
So our responsibility as the private side of this partnership has been to do all the initial planning and then secure the permits for this project. And just to be clear, we had a permit from the Surface Transportation Board, which is the largest of the agencies here that we needed a permit from. And the case before the Washington Circuit Court was asking that be thrown out. And as you stated, they prevailed in that. So what that means for us is that we have a number of options that we need to look at moving forward. And as it's only been a week since that case came through, the verdict came through, we're still working through what all of those options look like. But basically, the court order was that we go back and revise the environmental impact statement that we have with the Surface Transportation Board. There's a number of items there that they felt like we didn't look at, or the Surface Transportation Board didn't look at those as closely as they should have. And many of those are upstream and downstream of the actual road itself, which is why the Surface Transportation Board didn't look at those. And so that's one option.
I have to ask you, downstream, does that mean that we have to do an environmental impact statement on the entire railway network where the crude might potentially travel?
I'm afraid that in some people's opinions,
that doesn't make any sense.
That way. Well, I would not argue with that. I think primarily what the circuit court was requesting is that we look at the likely source of destination source for the waxy crude and look at that more particularly. But again, those who oppose the project, I don't think would rest if that was the extent of what we did. You know, give a mouse a cookie, right?
Right.
They always want more.
Wildfire risk was another thing that they brought up, issue that they brought up, and the impacts on water resources downline, including the Colorado River. So, like I said, does this project mean it takes account potential impacts of all products transported throughout the entire railway? Or are they just singling the Uinta Basin out?
I hope not. One of the strategies that we're looking at is going back before the circuit court and seeking clarification on some of these issues, because, again, there can be no end to it. And those who oppose,
can we seek clarification from the entire seven members?
That is our intent.
Okay. All right. So that would change things potentially a little bit. A special status species of increased drilling in the Uinta Basin. Now, aren't these considerations part of a production company's application for permission to drill?
Yes, absolutely.
So it's already being done.
Which is why, again, the Surface Transportation Board, which deals with transportation and a railroad in particular between point A and B in Utah, did not look at all of those things in exhaustive detail.
What about the effect of oil refining? Now, this doesn't make any, this is a word salad. Oil refining on environmental justice of communities in the Gulf Coast. What?
Yeah, that is, that's a mouthful, isn't it?
We're worried about the increased production and the effects that would have on communities in the Gulf Coast?
That was one of the issues that the judges brought up. As I understand it, again, not being an environmental expert, but environmental justice is that those live closest to a source of pollution are more impacted, and those people tend to be more economically challenged anyway. So the problem with that request is that, again, we do not know specifically which refineries this product will go to. Right. And it also makes some terrible assumptions that there would be an increase in production and that it would be more harmful. When, as was pointed out by Mark Michelle, in all likelihood, the refining of waxy crude from the Uinta Basin is going to be cleaner than what is currently being produced there. And so it would improve the environmental impact and the environmental justice situation in whatever refinery it was refined at. And furthermore, if I might add, that most of those refineries are at 95 to 100% capacity right now, as are the refineries in Salt Lake. So in all likelihood, what would be happening is that the waxy crude from the Uinta Basin would be replacing waxy crude that comes from another source, whether that's within the United States or from South America or Saudi Arabia or Canada or who knows where. So there wouldn't actually be an increase in production. There would probably actually be a decrease in pollution because of the low sulfur content and the other characteristics of our waxy crude. So from our perspective, we're doing, you know, those people a favor, and we're doing the world a favor by getting our product out into the open market because it's a superior product.
Thank you, Keith. If you're just joining us, we are visiting with representatives from the Uinta Railway. We have Mark Michelle, who is a representative of Drexel Hamilton Infrastructure Partners, Keith Heaton, executive director of the Seven County Infrastructure Coalition, and of course, Duchesne County Commissioner Greg Miles, who also serves as co-chair of the Seven County Infrastructure Coalition. And we're discussing the Surface Transportation Board's, the appeals, U.S. Court of Appeals of District of Columbia's August 18th ruling, which struck down the Surface Transportation Board's approval of the construction project and the consequences of that going forward. Now, gentlemen, I have some questions, regarding for the team questions. What are some of the options available to the project post this court ruling? Mark, Michelle, you kind of mentioned a couple of them earlier. What are some of the options available to the project team?
Sure. There's really three options as we see it legally. Option A is to request what's called a writ of certiorari, which is a hearing at the U.S. Supreme Court. That's available to us, which would be to elevate the case out of the D.C. Circuit up to the Supreme Court. There's also option B, which is to receive an en banc hearing, which is instead of just having the case heard by three of the 11 judges at the D.C. Circuit Court level, we could request that all 11 judges hear the case and expand the audience of judges from 3 to 11. And then, of course, we could just option C, which would be to follow the decision's recommendation and order, which is to go back to the Surface Transportation Board and just amend our EIS with the data points that they have asked us to include, which, as Keith was mentioning, a review of environmental impacts at refinery destinations as well as in the basin. So we could obviously just include that into our EIS and then submit it for reapproval under the existing EIS that's been exhaustively put together. So those are the three courses of action as we see it. Hopefully that answered your question.
Thank you. Mark, Michelle, are there transportation options beyond Colorado, or does that really matter regarding the court ruling?
So those of your audience that may or may not really understand how the rail network truly runs, the line that runs between Denver, Colorado, and Salt Lake City is owned by the Union Pacific, but it has what's called dual trackage rights, where BNSF has the ability to run trains on that line. But the Union Pacific actually owns what's called the Overland Route, which is to go north up to Ogden, and then to go that east-west run that goes through southern Wyoming back over to Omaha. So the Union Pacific actually prefers to run these long trains on that northern route because it's less the topography is less challenging. They can run faster because it's flatter. And so most of the traffic, particularly the stuff that the Union Pacific would haul, to points east and south, would likely go on that route. So most of the volumes would not even go through Colorado. It's only the volumes that would have to go on to Burlington Northern Santa Fe, BNSF, that would be required to go through those mountain areas of Colorado that the environmentalists were trying to pick on. So it's not even, I wouldn't even say it would be even anywhere close to 50% of the volumes. I think most of the volumes of the basin and on this railway would venture north and then east.
So it's a misconception to think or to believe, as was being argued by many, that all of this crude oil is going to be transported through pristine areas of Colorado.
Right. The railroads prefer not to go through Colorado because they have to run slower and up and down more challenging topography through mountain passes. So they actually prefer to run north where it's a lot flatter and just, and, you know, they burn less fuel carrying it across a flatter surface. And so it's just more economical and it's less traffic. So last thing they want to be doing is bringing a train in through Denver. It's just it's a more congested area, and it makes less sense from just a commercial level to do it that way. So yeah, I mean, as I think Keith and Greg were both articulating on points earlier, you know, there's a lot of what was being said in the media disparaging the project that was really not intellectually accurate and intellectually honest. You know, the fact that I believe it was Commissioner Miles that was saying that you know, if there was a spill, you know, this is transported in essence in the form of a candle or shoe polish. So, you know, if there was a spill, the spill would be picked up with shovels and it would be picked up in a solid state. You know, this crude starts to congeal and solidify when it's colder than 110 degrees. So it comes out of the ground hot because it's not coming under pressure and heat. And then once it starts to cool with the ambient temperature, especially, you know, 6 or 7 months of the year when there's snow on the ground in Utah, you know, this stuff cools off quite quickly and drops below that 110 Fahrenheit pour point, and it starts to turn into that solid wax candle consistency. So if there was to be a spill or a derailment, you know, the stuff on the ground would be picked up with a shovel, and the any oil that did actually go into any sort of waters would be you know, would float, and it would not mix with the water. So, you know, they made it sound a lot more you know, making it sound like this is going to be Exxon Valdez spilled all over the Colorado River, and it's just not the case. It's not that type of oil, because of the physical properties of the paraffin. So, you know, and I think I heard an accurate point in there as well as about the wildfires. You know, the flash point on this stuff is nowhere near like what it would be for a Bakken barrel of crude oil or something of that nature, which has much more higher volatility than this is. So it's a very safe commodity and a product to move. It frankly doesn't even classify as a hazmat because of its physical properties. So there was a lot of consternation and you know, I think a lot of falsehoods that were spread in the media and a lot of the politicians over there in Colorado and others that were obviously opponents of the project tried to paint the worst possible picture, but it just wasn't intellectually accurate.
Final question is, where do we go from here? You mentioned an adjusted timeline. How long do you anticipate?
Legal proceedings take time, and this one is political as well, so that is a little bit of a wild card. We're anticipating 1 to 2 years. Hopefully it's on the lower end of that scale, but whereas we are hoping to begin construction in 2024, that may be pushed back to 2025.
Okay. Thank you.
And I would add, you know, this wasn't a downturn of the project. This basically sent the project back for further review. So, you know, we'll
put that into perspective. It's going back for further review, and there are options that are available to the team.
Yeah, and I know when people hear NEPA, they think, you know, that's the place where good projects go to die.
Right.
We'll work with our federal partners. You know, we, as Keith mentioned, we've got a great relationship with U.S. Forest Service. Mm-hmm. We've got a great relationship with the Surface Transportation Board and every other federal agency. And worst case scenario, we'll survive the the environmental review, and we'll be back with the project.
All right. Well, thank you. On that note, I think we'll close the program. We want to thank Mark Michel with Drexel Hamilton Infrastructure Partners for taking time to join us this evening. Also, Keith Heaton, Executive Director of the Seven County Infrastructure Coalition, and our Duchesne County Commissioner, Commissioner Greg Miles, who also serves as co-chair of the Seven County Infrastructure Coalition. I'm Steve Evans, and we thank you for joining us on this special program here on News Talk 104.5 FM and AM 920 KVEL.